From WGCU, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. All this week, NPR has been focused on A Nation Engaged, an effort asking people across the country, what do you want the new president to know about you and your community as he takes office? Now it's our turn here in Southwest Florida. We are asking you and a group of guests in our studio to tell us where you're coming from and what your hopes and concerns are on this, the day before Donald Trump's inauguration. Plus, we'll talk with a doctor of political science about the history of inaugurations, what elements are critical to the ceremony, where symbolism can be found, and how does the 2017 inaugural week differ from others? But first, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Tomorrow, the 45th President of the United States will be inaugurated into office, and that's what we're talking about on our show today. We'll take a look back at the long line of historic and history-making inaugurations a little later in the show, but first we're talking with people about their hopes and concerns going forward. This isn't a forum to bash or gloat about the President-elect or to review the past election. It's simply a forum for our guests, listeners, and callers to say directly to the new administration, this is who I am, and this is what my community is going through right now. It's part of a national dialogue started by NPR called A Nation Engaged, and the dialogue focuses on the question, what do you want the president to know about you or your community as he takes office? We invite you to get involved in the conversation by calling 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. We are joined in the studio with some people who'd like to answer this call to be part of A Nation Engaged. First, we have Mohammed Al-Darsani with the Islamic Center for Peace. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Jaleesha McCoy, an FGCU student who I met a couple of months ago. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Arlene Goldberg, who is a Southwest Florida LGBT plus activist. She's in the studio with us today as well. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We will also have Tori Renza eventually joining us. She is a college student at FGCU, the daughter of a Colombian immigrant, and she's also a veteran of the Iraq War and vice president of the Southwest Florida Young Republicans Group. She'll be here in just a few seconds. But we want to also ask the general public to give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. We'd like to hear what you want the new president to know about you or your community as he takes office. Mohammed Al-Darsani, how would you answer the question, what do you want the new president to know about you or your community as he takes office?
Well, first of all, I want to thank WGCU for this initiative, getting the community engaged and a diverse group of people to come and discuss these issues. As a Muslim, and as a Muslim activist, not only in the, on the religious side, also in the political side also, I would like to see the next administration in general, and Mr. Trump in particular, to tone down the rhetoric that they had during the campaign. The Muslim community, as a minority, small minority in this country, have an anxiety just like every other minority. We're not fearing the government. We're not fearing the system. The system has the ability to correct itself. What we are fearing, the ignorance on the part of some people where they will take this rhetoric and the actions of the officials and the leaders of the country as a role model to imitate and to start acting upon it. We already at the Muslim community, not necessarily here in Southwest Florida, but all over the country, we've been seeing a lot of violence. You may not know that because you don't hear it on the news as often as it should, as it happens, really. Almost every single day, there's an attack of some sorts on Muslims or Muslim facilities. Mosques has been burned, vandalized. People have been killed, literally, stabbed, kicked around. Imams have been killed and attacked on the streets after leaving prayers. Women have been attacked. Their hijabs were pulled off their heads. a lot of things are happening. Discrimination of all kind of sorts, whether in housing, in employment, in all aspects of life. The Muslim community started seeing things that we've never experienced in the past in this country, where the Muslim community, probably as a minority, is the largest minority contributor to the prosperity and the advancements of this country. The highest education in any minority is in the Muslim community. The professional level is higher than any other minority, even the majority itself. So we have a lot to contribute. And the attitude, the negative attitude toward the community will result in negative attitude toward the system, toward the society, the local community. And there is something unique also about the Muslim community, unlike the others, because of the teaching of the Islamic religion. We don't retreat. We'll confront the adversities. We will confront the obstacles with bravery and with all the lawful, peaceful means that are possible and available to us. So we expect and we pray, and this is happening literally in the Muslim community. We are praying to the success of Trump and his administration. We really are. We don't view him as an enemy or as an adversary to us. We view him as somebody who came with different ideas to change the path of this country. He challenged the establishment and he succeeded. And we hope he succeeds in his presidency, because his success is a success to the whole nation, including us as a part of this nation. We'll be praying and helping when he's right. When he's wrong, we'll definitely be standing up with those who are voicing their concerns about his actions.
Jaleesha McCoy, as a millennial and an African-American woman, tell us a bit about you and what you would like the incoming administration to know about you and your peers.
Well, to start off, me being a millennial, the only president I was like actually able to live through and like understand what was going on was our soon-to-be former president, Barack Obama. And one thing that I can say is he was very personable, and he always had our best interests at heart when it comes to young people. And one thing that I hope Trump does keep when he does come into office, that he keeps our best interests at heart. And he tries to look out for us, and he is a role model and shows that he is for us, because at the end of the day, he's our president. So people are going to follow in whatever he says and what his beliefs are as well. And being African-American, it goes the same way. We already know what's going on with police brutality and things like that that's going on, and certain remarks he's said about African-Americans during his speeches. And he has a big following of people who, it's crazy, but they are condoning what he says, and just them condoning what he says and him coming into office, it kind of scares me a little bit, because it's like, with him being okay with saying such, you know, racial slurs about anything, even outside of African Americans, just like he was talking about the Muslims and things like that. At the end of the day, I want him and his administration to be a proper example, and the example that is going to keep the threads, you know, together and not pull us together, because we're already divided as well. So that's one thing that I'm hoping that he can live up to and exceed and be successful with that.
I want to turn now to Tori Renza. Thanks for being here. In addition to being a college student and a leader in the local Republican club, you're also a veteran. What do you think is important for the incoming administration to know about where you're coming from?
Oh, thank you so much for having me. You know, I kind of want to piggyback on the things that he has said, and because as a veteran, I fought alongside with a lot of Muslims, and I think that they have contributed a lot to this country. They have literally given their lives to be American citizens, and also the moderates in the Middle East. And I reluctantly, you know, voted for Trump, but at the end of the day, I had to think about what was best for my country. And being a veteran, I have always had to sacrifice and put my country's needs ahead of me. And I certainly could not vote you know, for Hillary Clinton just because of her record. But it does bother me the things that he has said, especially being a female, an immigrant. But at the same time, you know, it is just rhetoric, and I had to really think about his actions. I mean, he has employed a lot of immigrants, and they do work for him. So I think that he just really said those things to fire up the conservative base. And he just really wanted to build the following and really distinguish himself from the rest of the candidates. But as a veteran, I think that it's important that we keep our commitment to the Middle East. Absolutely. I believe that they should have a democracy. I believe that, you know, I think about the translators that helped us. I think about all of the civilians, and I think about the refugees and the Peshmerga fighters. And all those people that are still there, still fighting for the same things that we want, you know, that we Americans want, that we value, religious freedom, whether you're, you know, a Muslim or whether you're a Christian. And I think that it's important that Trump continue to honor the promises that we have made in the Middle East, and we, you know, continue to fight alongside so that they may get away from that. There is... I hate to say tyrannical regime, but I just really hope that as a person who was in the military, that we honor the promise that we have made to the Middle East.
Can I comment on something?
Yeah, sure,
you just said?
Yeah.
First of all, thank you for your service story, and I'm proud to sit beside you in this interview. One of the contributions that I didn't mention really is the military contributions of the Muslim community in this country. I'm not talking about somebody else. I'm talking about myself. My son is a captain in the U.S. Army. He served a tour in Iraq. And he's in South Korea today as we speak now. So our community is not a strange community. It's not. All my kids were born and raised here in this country, and this community in particular. And for somebody to come and dismiss the whole community based on the religion, it is difficult. And I do appreciate everything you said.
It sounds like we have a recurring theme of dialing back the rhetoric. It seems like everybody's hopes at this point
is... We hope so. We really do. And on the policies of the United States toward the Middle East and the foreign policies, I hope this administration will take a different path and execute a policy based on principles, not interest and lies, and in promoting the American values and democracy in the Middle East so people can feel free and have the respect again for the United States.
I'm going to turn now to Arlene Goldberg with Southwest Florida as a LGBTQ plus activist. What would you like the incoming president to know about you and the LGBTQ plus community?
Well, thank you for having me. And Tori, thank you so much for serving. Really appreciate it. Well, I think our community, the LGBTQ community, is pretty concerned about what's to come during the next 4 years. We've moved so far ahead with President Obama. Don't Ask, Don't Tell going away, and same-sex marriage being approved. And we're concerned about who he has appointed to his cabinet. They're very conservative, and Pence specifically is so against the LGBT community. And so we're very concerned about that. We are trying to move ahead locally here. We feel like we can do more, we can help better locally here and change some policies in a very conservative town that we live in to help the LGBT community, like work with the county and work with the cities and get that done rather than working on a federal level right now, because that's pretty difficult because it's already set. And we're just hoping that they'll see us as people and that the only difference is who we love and that they will treat us like everybody else, let us move forward.
Instead of going backwards,
yeah. We've gone so much forward ahead that we are concerned about that. So we're working – our community here in Southwest Florida is working very hard to move forward within the community.
We do have a caller on the line, Victor from Fort Myers. Victor, what would you like to add to the conversation today?
First of all, my appreciation for your panel that you have there. Very well spoken and a lot of points made. There is one thing that I'd like to address, and it's very simple. The president is surrounding himself with the 1%. I, along with everybody else, is part of the 99%. I really think the 99% should tell the president to tell his cabinet and to have them share the wealth. If they're all billionaires and here we are basically working paycheck to paycheck, I'm certainly hoping that the policies they're going to put into place are definitely going to be able to go down the line and so that the richer don't get richer and the poor get poor. But I hope you understand what I'm saying. Spread the wealth. At least give everybody else an advantage, a shot at least trying to make a decent living. I've been here in Florida for 20-odd years, and I'm still making barely enough, like I said, paycheck to paycheck. So whatever comments you have, I'll take them off the air.
All right. I appreciate it. Does anybody have a comment on that as far as having on in the cabinet the 1%?
I think that setting up the community as a setting up his cabinet with the 1% is totally inappropriate, because what that does is it makes the rest of us feel like what about us? That 1% doesn't represent us.
Yeah.
Doesn't represent us at all.
We have another caller on a different line, sounds like, in the studio.
We do. It doesn't represent us at all. It represents that 1%. It doesn't make us feel like we're part of anything.
I can see. What do you think about that? Tori, this is – I don't put you on the spot because you're
not the one
that made the cabinet appointments or – what do you think about that?
I think it's just really an overall representation of where we are in politics. I think that politicians, there's such a difference between, you know, we the people and the people that we have elected. And I think that over, you know, even just the last couple of decades, there has been so much money filtered into politics, and we need more focus on the 99%. I mean, we're the ones that pay taxes. We're the ones that, you know, work in the morning, feed our children. And I think that it's important to not just think about the fact that, you know, Trump surrounds himself with a bunch of people with money, but I think that politicians in general have surrounded themselves with money. And, you know, look at Barack Obama. You know, he was a celebrity president, and a lot of his friends were from Hollywood. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, because Hollywood really liked him. And he did a lot of good things for liberals in this country. So I think that we as citizens need to find a way how we can, you know, bring the money back locally instead of spending so much, allowing the federal government to spend so much money and just really focus on state politics.
State and local. Making it decentralized up in Washington and bringing it home, kind of like what you were talking about, Arlene, mm-hmm. a little bit, trying to make more mm-hmm. of a difference locally.
Mm-hmm. Can I just say one more thing?
Sure.
On the policy of don't ask, don't tell, I do want to say that it was the log cabin Republicans who really campaigned for that legislation to get onto Barack Obama's desk. So I just really wanted to put that out there.
You feel like that was more of a bipartisan effort?
It certainly was. And I mean, I am a Republican, but I have marched with the gay community. And I fully support you, because you know what? Gay people have died for this country. And at the end of the day, that's really all that matters to me.
Just like everybody else.
Yeah.
As a veteran.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
And on a comment on the call Victor just made,
sure.
And the idea he brought, hopefully we'll see the 99% more organized, more engaged, more participating now in the process, because this is the last chance. Otherwise, it will be decades before any corrections can happen. Trump's phenomena is a reaction to what has been happening in the last 40 or 50 years.
Yes,
in
it
this
didn't
country.
Happen overnight.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And if these 99% do not get back on the streets, in the parks, and everywhere, and have their own forums and their organizations, and show power to restore, not to restore, we still have democracy, to enforce the democracy and to bring back the values that were everybody in this country worked hard and people died to preserve them, we're going to see them disappearing.
Do you feel like this has been a wake-up call, Jalisha, particularly with young people? Do you feel like this has been a bit of a wake-up call for people to get more involved and active in learning about what's going on politically?
Definitely, because with everything that's going on, at the end of the day, everything that's, just like he said, everything that's being done now, at the end of the day, it's going to affect us and the generations to come after us. So people are starting to wake up and realize that they need to read, they need to talk, they need to have these conversations, they need to be here, they need to be there, they need to be fully aware of what's going on, because closed mouths don't get fed. So if you don't do anything or try to be a part of anything, things will happen and it'll be completely out of your control because you didn't step up to the plate when you had the opportunity. So I feel like as young people, we're starting to realize that we have to do what's in our best interest at first, because we have our backs, and at the end of the day, we're given the opportunity to make decisions that's best for us. So we just have to take advantage of what's given to us, and we have to, you know, just be prepared to do what we have to do, because if we don't, it'll affect us, and then there'll be nothing we can do, because if you don't do anything about it, you can't sit around and complain.
We are asking people to become a nation engaged, and we're asking what you think that the incoming president and administration should know about you and your community. We invite you to give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK, or you can find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. And we did receive a tweet from the Caloosahatchee River Watch. They would like to say that they would like the president to look into the protection of our local waters as a priority and looking to the EPA to strengthen the provision of the Clean Water Act. That is a concern coming in via Twitter from the Caloosahatchee River Watch. Mohammed Al-Darsani, we hear a lot about how this country is divided. It's in the headlines a lot. Do you feel like locally you're seeing that same type of division?
On the local level, yes, there is some kind of divisions. I'm not talking just about the religious divisions. I'm talking about racial. I'm talking about economical. It is not hard for anybody to drive from our place here in the south side of the county and go up north and see the difference, the contrast. And that's on the economic level. On the racial level, unfortunately, it is worse today than when I came back. I came to this community back in 1990, and now we are in 2017, and unfortunately, the divide is much, much larger. And the same things I used to see 25, 30 years ago on the east side of the county or of the city of Fort Myers, nothing changed. Stagnation for certain people, and that must end. And how we end it? By getting also all together. It is not the job of the government alone, not the job of the people of color or different nationality alone. It is the job of everybody.
It's kind of an ideological divide, too. Are you feeling that kind of stretch?
Absolutely, yes.
I want to touch on what he was saying, because, I mean, I'm originally from Miami, so the community down there is completely different from what's in Fort Myers, and just I've been here for like 3 years now attending school, and just even driving from Estero and going like 2-3 exits down, it's a completely different city than it is, and at the end of the day, it's like he said, it has to do with the community, but people also have to think about the small government as well, too, not just the big picture. You have to think about the mayors and the senators that people elect, because at the end of the day, they're the ones that's making the decisions. They're the ones that's keeping people oppressed or in poverty and that kind of thing. So people have to do research on that kind of stuff, too. And just recently, I was at a MLK breakfast celebration and just seeing the type of activists that were down there, and they've been trying for like over 5+ years trying to get the community back. And it's crazy because you come down here and then even in Naples, I heard Naples is one of the richest communities. And it's like, but what are they doing? Because at the end of the day, they're keeping their hands in their pockets and they're not taking anything out of their pockets to try to help the, you know, the people who need help. And they're just, like you said, it's stagnant. And you go down there and you can just tell as soon as you get off the exit, it's just completely different.
I think a lot of cities across America have the same type of a symptom of socioeconomic divides. But I think that what's kind of come to light in the last year is an ideological divide where people are very far on either side. Do you feel that way, Arlene?
Yeah, I do. There's very little in the middle right now. You're either very far to the left or very far to the right.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel that way.
And Tori, do you feel this? Do you feel this kind of really extreme one side or the other?
Absolutely. I mean, especially being in politics and I experience it firsthand. And I receive a lot of backlash, you know, from a lot of my liberal friends. But the fact is, you know, I'm still pretty middle of the road compared to the rest of the party, you know. And but the truth is, we are so divided and we are so polarized. And I think that it has been growing, you know, for the past couple of decades, and particularly in my opinion underneath the Barack Obama administration, and that filters down, you know, locally, unfortunately. And, you know, we have a lot of racial tensions in this country, and, you know, I really feel like we can find the middle of the road, and it's really saddening to see how different everything is and how divided it is.
Do you think this ideological divide has pushed people, but you think that this occurred during the Barack Obama administration more so, or accelerated during that time?
I think it accelerated.
Why do you think that? I'm just curious.
I just think that because, you know, he was so liberal, a lot of people, you know, middle America had a problem with a lot of his policies. And I think that, you know, that's why we ended up having Donald Trump as president. There was a backlash because of that.
Do you think they felt that he was so far left that they reacted in kind by retreating further right?
I believe that we were pushed farther right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. They pushed in that direction. Okay. Well, we have a couple calls coming in. We have Ron who would like to ask a question. Ron, how are you?
I'm great.
Okay, can you tell me what you would like to tell the incoming administration?
Well, I would like a complete turnaround from what I feel is the lawlessness of the Obama administration. He's created the racial divide, in my opinion, with his policies, with letting criminals go free, reducing sentences, in letting criminals in Guantanamo.
Okay. Well, rather than talk about what we didn't like about the past, what we're talking about today is what you would like to see going forward. So what would you like to say to the incoming administration, and what is important to you about what we can do going forward?
Well, stop full-fledged immigration until we have a vetting process that controls who's coming in and out.
Do you know what the current vetting process is for immigration?
Pardon me?
Do you know what the current vetting process is for immigration?
All I know is they're coming in leaps and bounds from the Mexican border.
Well, that would be illegal immigration.
I agree wholeheartedly with virtually everything Donald Trump has said.
Okay. Well, I guess you're saying congratulations to Donald Trump. And thank you for your call. We also have a call coming in from Susan, who is also in Fort Myers. Susan, what would you like to say?
I'd like to refer back to Terry Gross's last program, just before you, talking about ethics. I think that I would like to tell the administration, especially the president, that we will be keeping his feet to the fire as far as getting himself out of business and taking care of the country instead of taking care of him. He needs to divest himself of his property all over the world and take care of the nation. I feel that all of his appointees to the cabinet, these are all very wealthy people who have made a lot of money and that's what their interests are. We need to put America, really put America first. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your comments. And I wanted to talk about the ideological divide that we were talking about earlier. And we have people that want to go very far in one corner or the other. I want to get suggestions from those of you in the room with me and anybody who'd like to call in about how do we overcome that? What kind of things do you see making it possible maybe for us to move forward? Arlene.
Well, I see us moving forward locally first, because this county that we live in here does not have any protections for the LGBT community at all. And that's a problem for us in housing, in public services, in at work. So those are the things we need to work at locally.
And how do you want to do that? By starting conversations or meeting with some leaders? Or?
Well, we've already done that. We've already met with the county administrator, Cape Coral, city of Cape Coral is already working on some of that. And our goal is to do this locally, because nationally it's not going to get done with this administration, clearly. So what our goal is to have a complete ordinance here for the LGBT community, so that we would they cannot discriminate against the LGBT community. We're like anybody else.
Jalisha, talking about the ideological divide that we were mentioning earlier, and not to, you know, keep bringing it up, how do you think that people would best overcome this?
Well, I always say you have to have a conversation first, because just even hearing some of the callers and things that they were saying, they were like, they were just against everything. And he wasn't even fully, you know, equipped with knowledge to make the certain remarks he was making. So I feel like you have to educate people and have a conversation, and also start locally, because you can't do something on such a big scale if your backyard isn't put together first. So you always have to start in the backyard, and then, you know, head down the driveway and then go to another community and all that other stuff.
And then work your way out. Work your way out from inside. Muhammad Al-Darsani, what do you think?
Well, first let me say this. I think calling it ideological divide is a misnomer.
It's, okay.
Honestly, it's tribal divide. Ideologically, most people have no clue what their ideology is, whether they voted for Clinton or for Obama. The only ideologically aware people, those who voted for the other candidates. That's the only ones who are aware ideologically. We have a tribal divide. And unfortunately, this tribal divide is not on ethnic or color or any backgrounds except financial. Every time you hear something, always the dollar and cents is thrown in there. What am I going to get? How he's going to give me? How much he's going to make? As long as we think in that line, this divide will get wider, because the division between those who have and have a lot and those who don't have is getting wider. It's not ideological really more than it is economical and a mentality set. Nobody wants to do anything anymore for the value, for the sake of doing what is good and what is right. Always for what is the bottom line in it for me. The previous caller talked about, I was listening to the same program. We are worrying if he's going to benefit. He's going to benefit, absolutely. He may not benefit in these 4 years or 8 years, but later on he'll be cashing by tens of billions of dollars easily. I mean, there are so many ways to rig the system or to take advantage of the system. And this president, upcoming president, knew. He defeated the governments and the system at every corner. He outmaneuvered the whole system. He's smart. He didn't do anything illegal. I give him credit for that. Nothing illegal. So far, we know nothing. So, which is fine. The system allows it. He took advantage of it. But ideologically, if we don't go back to the principles, to the values of this nation, to the Constitution, this divide is going to get wider. And unfortunately, it's going to be uglier.
And real quick, I want to turn to Tori. What do you think about how to bridge these kind of divides, tribal or otherwise?
I think that we have to come together as a people to really change legislation. I want to talk about two things real quick. The caller mentioned how I staunchly believe in criminal justice reform. I think that we have a lot of minorities that are incarcerated, and of course that builds a lot of resentment towards authority. And I also want to bring up the fact that Barack Obama actually deported the greatest amount of illegal immigrants since he has been in office, which actually really has bothered me. And most people would think like, oh, you're a Republican, you know, you don't want those people here. Of course I want those people here. Those are immigrants. They contribute. And America was founded and built by immigrants. And I think that just here in this room, you know, if we were to have a if we were to take this conversation, you know, contact an organization like change.org, file petitions, you know, and go to Congress with these things, that's where you make a difference, and that's where you can bridge the divide among people. Because I think that at the end of the day, we have more in common than, you know, Washington wants us to believe. I think that really they want us to be divided and think that we are divided. But we, the people, are the ones that put them in office, and the answer to us.
I feel like conversations like this are helping to move that forward to where we're all talking together and not talking from separate corners of the world. We have another call coming in from Ryan with FGCU. What would you like to tell the current administration or the upcoming administration? Ryan?
I believe that it's the discourse that we've seen over this last year has been adversarial, and Mr. Trump or President-elect Trump has used a very transactional approach to whether it be Chinese trade policies, immigration. And I think to step back and take it from a different perspective rather than the two-party system, which is, you know, very polar, very opposite, to take it as we both have the same goal for the country. It's just different approaches, whether it is getting sick people covered, which Mr. Pence yesterday spoke on and kind of tried to clarify that, but to really take an approach that says that we are going for a better country, but our approaches are differently. And I think that would create more of a better conversation, a better dialogue to really be productive.
All right. Well, thank you for your comments. I really appreciate you calling in. And Patrick is calling in from Cape Coral. Patrick, what would you like to tell the incoming administration?
Hey, real quick, I just want to comment on all you guys. Excellent panel today, and listening to the show, I don't hear a Muslim. I don't hear, you know, somebody representing the LGBTQ community. I don't hear a young black woman served in the military. I hear Americans, and I think that needs to be the focal point. I mean, I'm a registered Republican. I guess I count as a millennial, born in the early 80s. I've voted independent the last three cycles because I just don't – I've never liked the choices. But my message to the administration, honestly, would be he's got it. I'm not a fan of him, but I want to see him do a good job. You got the position. Act presidential already. Get off Twitter. Stop making a mockery of it. It's a prestigious thing. You need to now face the music. You need to live up, and you need to be there for all of us. And that's it. Kind of what the previous caller said and a couple others, that the polarization is just insane. And you know, it's the rhetoric. He needs to really focus on rallying everybody together, and he needs to include, not exclude. And that's my biggest point.
And that sentiment is echoed on Twitter from Trey Savage, who tweeted in, "I'd like to see President-elect Donald Trump decrease his racial rhetoric and increase his support of the U.S. being united." On that note, I want to thank you all for coming in and being on this panel today, and a lot of our callers who are really made me feel great about all of us. And I liked his comment that I don't hear an African-American LGBT. I fear Americans, which I think is really great. So I want to thank you for coming in. Muhammad Al-Darsani with Islamic Center for Peace, Jaleesha McCoy, FGCU student, Tori Renza, FGCU student also, and veteran and Vice President of Young Republicans, and also Arlene Goldberg, activist with the LGBT community here in Southwest Florida. Thank you all for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up, the inauguration ceremony itself has blossomed over the years from a simple swearing-in to a week-long event complete with balls, parades, and speeches. We'll take a look back to put tomorrow into context next. Welcome back. I'm Julie Glenn. The first presidential inauguration was held in the then capital of the U.S., New York City, on April 30th, 1789. George Washington was a general, and he lived in Virginia. He traveled by coach and on horseback through Baltimore, Wilmington, Philadelphia to be sworn in with his hand on a Bible. The hand on a Bible has remained a constant of inaugural events throughout history, but almost everything else has changed. Here to talk to us about inaugurating new U.S. presidents is Dr. Peter Bergerson, who's a professor of political science here at FGCU. Thank you for being here today.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks.
We are talking about inaugurations in general, their history, and what traditions you'll be seeing playing out tomorrow. You can become part of the conversations by calling us at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK, or find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. While riding horseback to one's inauguration went by the wayside many years ago, we now have bulletproof limos, the level of pomp and circumstance seems to have gradually increased over time. Dr. Bergerson, tell me a little about how inaugurations were and what they've evolved into now.
Well, they originally were pretty much pro forma, but they always have been a celebration, and they always have been a recognition of the peaceful transfer of power from either one party or at least one person to the next leadership. It's an indication also of a celebration. That is a big part of it. The symbolism is a big part of it, and always has been. The parades have almost always been a part of it. For instance, Lincoln, President Lincoln, in his first inauguration, he was the first to include African Americans as part of the parade. Thomas Jefferson, as you suggested, he was the first president to take the oath of office in Washington, D.C. One of the things we may see unfold tomorrow is some elements of protest, which, again, are not new to inaugurations, only two in recent times. Why we have seen, for instance, in Richard Nixon's inauguration, the anti-war protests were very, very prominent. In 2001, George W. Bush's inauguration was one of the Mars, I guess, of it, or at least one of the aspects of it was the protests that came with his election. But the real message, I think, and the real significance from a political science perspective is not only the transfer of power, but the presidential address.
The address. Is that what you're looking forward to tomorrow?
Yeah, I am. The inaugural address really is, I think, very critical. It presents the president's worldview. It's an opportunity for firsthand to see what he really sees as his core values. What are his principles? How does he define the world? How does he see it? Where does he and what does he see in matters of priority? What are the things in which he hopes to accomplish? And so he's going to set a theme, a tone. He's going to outline what he sees as the role, at least of the presidency, but of the government as well, and our body politics as our role, and what's the appropriate role for government and society.
I wanted to ask you about the role of the president. It seems like the inauguration was not as big of a deal as it's become in most recent cycles, but the office of president and the powers of president have remained the same?
No, they have not. They have, you know, originally when the Constitution was written, almost most of the powers, at least the Founding Fathers thought, was going to be enumerated and listed in the Constitution in Article 1 for the legislature. And there was really a considerable debate and discussion, A, how long the president should serve. Some wanted 4 years. Some wanted 6 years. Some wanted even a life term, you know, somewhat similar to a king. They obviously resolved it by having a four-year term in which it could be reelected until that change came about.
Oh, the first vice president, they were debating what to call the office of the president, and he wanted his benign highness. That was the original plan from the first. Right. I just read that today. I was like, His Benign Highness?
Yeah. And even, you know, one of the ways that the presidency has changed is that originally the vice president was the runner-up, the person with the second most electoral college votes. So really the modern presidency today has really evolved from FDR and the role that the president takes now. And he's really no longer a caretaker. He's no longer really just a clerk. He really is the person who initiates almost all of the legislation. He's primarily in charge of the budget, which is one of the most, if not the most important government document. All of these things have really centered around the president. And so the presidency, every president in some ways changes the office. And so part of the powers of the president, some of them are enumerated in the Constitution. Some are given to the office by statute. Some of them are given or at least reinforced by the court. And each president in some ways adds to the power the president has by making decisions that fill in the gaps that are, you know, the Constitution is fairly general and so is legislation. So presidential decisions fill in those gaps, and subsequently the power of the president is a cumulative one.
Back to tomorrow, tell me a little bit about some of the symbols that we're going to see there. There's some significance being attached to the Bible that's being used to swear in?
That of course, is a very important symbol based on, in essence, ages old idea of upholding, you know, your word is going to be the word and, in essence, the truth of the Bible. That's kind of the symbolism. I think also one of the other symbolisms that will be pointed out, at least those are radio commentators and most likely television, is who is on the dais with the president. And you'll see not only most likely the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and other members of the Supreme Court, but you'll also see members of Congress and members of the Republican and Democratic Party. So you'll see the symbolism of the three branches of government there. And then, of course, the parade is also a very symbolic of that there's going to be elements in the parade from all of the 50 states. And so that will also be part of the symbolism. What will be some of the memorable phrases that President-elect Trump uses, those will be part of it as well.
And one of the symbols that will be noticeably absent are 60 Democrats in the House of Representatives who are making a public boycott of the inauguration. Have we ever seen elected officials refuse to be present at an inauguration?
Not as a matter of, at least as principle, as they have said. There obviously have been some that haven't made it for other reasons. But no, nothing of this size and nothing as public. In essence, a public protest in their disenchantment with President-elect Trump.
The day after the inauguration this week, hundreds of thousands of people are planning to march on Washington, and there are other more pointed protests planned. Inaugurations haven't been protested to this degree in the past. Why do you think that is this year?
Well, several things. One is that the country is extremely divided, and the election really pointed that out. It pointed out in the fact that Hillary Clinton got 2,800,000 more votes than did Donald Trump, but also that we're in a particular era of two camps and. The feelings are very high. The campaign was rough and ready. I mean, the insults, the negativity, and it's carried over. And particularly when the Democrats think that Hillary Clinton should have won, and so there's really a bad taste in the mouth. And there hasn't really been a bipartisan effort to unite the country around Donald Trump. That's been part of it, not only by his efforts, but of course the Democrats, they're not going to do it either. So, you know,
they're kind of reinforcing it by not being there.
Yeah.
And boycotting it.
Yeah.
After the inauguration, there's a congressional lunch on the Capitol. What is that about?
I'm sorry.
A congressional lunch?
Oh, a congressional lunch. Oh, yeah. Well, it just that again, tradition. The president will be sworn in and then immediately go to lunch with members of Congress. It's just a traditional and an opportunity to see that there's going to be a working relationship between Congress and the president. It's really more ceremonial. There's nothing really of anything significant going on, at least from a policy standpoint, but an exchange of ideas. The new members of the cabinet will most likely be there or close to be sworn in anyway. They're in the process of being approved by the Senate today, as a matter of fact, as we speak. So it's the norm. And most likely what you'll see tomorrow after the inauguration is that the president will sign some executive orders in doing away perhaps with something that President Obama did, or that's a very common practice again. And, for instance, you know, one of the major symbolic things that happened on inauguration when President Reagan was sworn in, the American hostages in Iran were released exactly on January 20th at 12 noon. And so this became part of the symbolism and the fact that these American hostages from the embassy in Tehran
were international moves could be triggered.
Yeah, and so it kind of set the tone. Here we are, a new president, new future, new goals, new aspirations. And one of the things that we should really remember is that not only will this be the focus for people in the United States to stop and pause and look, but also the whole world will be watching. I know that sometimes is a overused phrase, but that really will be, particularly when Donald Trump's comments about NATO, about Central Europe, his relationships with China, his relationships with Russia. These are going to be very critical.
Yeah. Well, we are out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there today. Thanks so much, Dr. Peter Bergerson, for coming in to put some historical perspective on Inauguration Day for us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you bet. Thank you.
Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith and directed by Richard Chinqui, with technical help from A.J. Leonard. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Tomorrow, Gulf Coast Live will be preempted for coverage of inauguration by NPR. We'll be back on Monday with our regular live show at 1 o'clock. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn.